Welcome to Health Stealth Radio, where we move away from the mundane to gather insights from the shadows. From the shadows of enterprise and patient cybersecurity. Yes, we surely believe that traditional themes like endpoint software and zero trust are critical, but given massive advances in AI, remote and wearable device hacking, and data hostage negotiators, there's a much darker side to cybersecurity, and not everyone is quite willing to talk about it in public. Health Stealth Radio will thrive on these topics and encourage fireside spats to debate them. Here's your host, Frank Katita.
Yeah, and welcome to this week's episode of Health Stealth Radio, bringing you insights from the shadows of healthcare enterprise and patient cybersecurity. This week's episode is admittedly selfish. I've had the great opportunity taking part in a cyber breach simulation with IBM in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I must admit, was one of the most interesting experiences in my time in tech, and especially in corporate communications. It reinforced the critical importance of building a corporate culture that spends as much time on the far-flung communications aspects of response as it does on the technology fortification. I don't say this very often, but my experience at the Range changed the way I think in my graduate courses that I teach and in my work as a healthcare technology writer and researcher. I think you'll see what I mean in the next 20 minutes. Today, we have the pleasure of welcoming Jake Paulson, Global Lead of X-Force Cyber Range and Cyber Crisis Management Team. If that doesn't sound like Health Stealth, nothing will. So, Jake, I'd like to thank you for joining us. So just to kick off, Jake, I'd just like to do a warm-up question and just tell us what a day in the life of Jake Paulson is like at IBM and what you do during your free time. I usually ask the free time question because in the world of cybersecurity, it's a 24/7 job and we're seeing the stress and pain that people have in this business. So what do you do during the day, and then what do you do to get away from it all?
Yeah, so hey, thanks for having me here, by the way, right? And appreciate being here. So the start to the day for me, I like to always start the day with me time, right? A little bit of centering. I think I'm a young father. I got a six-year-old and a four-year-old. So my me time is pretty limited. I got to make sure I do that real early before everybody else wakes up. So I think that a lot of that is based on as well some of my background in football and the military, just waking up early, getting physical fitness, kind of having some me time up front before everyone else gets running. But you know, on the flip side, right, we run a 24, a global delivery operation, right? And so we have customers all over the world in all different time zones. So sometimes I got phone calls with customers starting at 4 a.m. Sometimes I got them at 6 a.m. Sometimes I got them starting at 9 p.m., right? So the me time and the free time depends on what day and what kind of customers and discussions we have at what part of the week. But for the most part, right, like I start out me time in the day. But, you know, to make sure I get my kids ready out, have breakfast out to school. And then I start with some threat intelligence updates, what came through the night before, any updates from the night before, especially things that are really tracking, major news headlines that are important to our clients. And then, I kind of have a GTD, right? A get things done list that I've normally built the night before. I think that's the military officer in me, always having a checklist for one thing or another. And then and that's already prioritized for me because thankfully that's part of just being prepped from the night before. And for the most part, right, for the day, it's about 50% spent on clients, having calls with customers, making sure we're really effectively delivering, really, really impactful experiences for them. And then about the other half of the day is really making sure we're pushing forward our consulting practice.
That's great. So in the world of radio, I mean, we have to create the imagery of what you and I got to experience, or what you get to experience every day with the Cyber Range. So it's going to be a little bit of a challenge because it is really a visual platform and it's a visual simulation just because it has to be, obviously, in so many ways. So could you, just for the audience that has never heard of this before, could you tell our audience the range and the key elements that they would experience if they actually attended on site?
Yeah, so diplomatic is a word I like to often use here. You want to be really diplomatic in how you immerse customers into this, right? Because a crisis is generally going to be associated with some emotional response that's going to get triggered, right? And so we try and be diplomatic in how we trigger that emotional response. And so we do that by really immersing up customers in, very personal experiences and, that reflect their business and what they do for their job. So, if you think about this, right, like We want to make sure that we create an experience that's personal to them and to their role in their company, right? So you get 10, 15 people from a crisis management team. You want to have each one of those 10 to 15 people have a unique role and uniquely be, you know, evoking their response and their participation in one way or another, right? So if it's you're having a conversation with whoever's leading the finance, whoever's leading HR, whoever's leading communications, whoever's leading IT operations. And for the most part, right, like you want to be identifying how they would be interacting together in some sort of crisis response. And in that kind of crisis response, you know, there's a perfect world and then there's the world of everyone has a plan until you get punched in the mouth. And so lots of times there's some discomfort in there, right? There's a lot of expectations in reality setting that sometimes gets kind of blown through. Someone might have had a really inaccurate assumption, and at least that you were in a safe place where we can educate and work our way through some of those assumptions in reality setting and a safe place where, you know, no one's jobs are on the line and, you know, the survivability of the company isn't on the line.
It's interesting. The communications professor of me saw that emotion in reality when I attended. So I thought it was very, very interesting, the diversity of people that were in the room, first of all, and then the way that they reacted emotionally based on the intensity of the situation. I mean, anywhere from finance down to the receptionist at the front desk, which I thought was fascinating. So it's been about 4 years ago since I attended. And you know, obviously, just in that 4 years, the landscape has changed considerably in terms of cybersecurity, or maybe not in your point of view. There are probably things that are going to be stable and foundational. So what kinds of things have you had to do in order to evolve the cyber range with the landscape of the breach market and the response market as it is today?
Yeah, I'd say like there's a lot of hallmarks that are kind of consistent through, you know, as you're responding to a crisis or a cybersecurity incident. Sure, like the tactics tend, you know, the tactics really change, right? How breaches occur, how exploits occur, actions on objectives, those really change, right? Threat intelligence drives, new technology gets introduced. So at that tactical level, that's where a lot of that threat intelligence talks about, right? This is, you know, that's really where the, you know, in the trenches of cyber warfare, right? But at, you know, let's say the operational and strategic, like that director and executive level, like that doesn't have a ton of significant change in how an organization problem solves. Because that's really what you're doing in problem solving, right? Is you're reflecting how does the company's capability of crisis management, which is right, the people, the processes that you have in place, the partnerships you have in place, the data you have available to you, and the technology you have in place, right? Like other things that, you know, that change, right? A lot of the data stays the same. Technology might change a little bit and people might change a little bit, but the processes and the partnerships, right? Like you want to make sure you have those identified. You know, one of the things I learned in the military a lot is people come and go, right? In the military, you move around a lot, but the process, the doctrine, the policy, that stays, right? And that at least puts a single frame of reference, a single plan that everyone aligns to, right? None of us are above the policy. None of us are above the plan. This at least gives us a framework to collaborate together, right? And you don't want it to be super prescriptive that imprisons people to really a finite set of tasks. You want it to allow, you know, enable people to come together and effectively problem solve together. And one of the hallmarks that we see of companies that over the last 4 years that we've really seen come out is that problem-solving culture, right? Like that there is no bad idea, that there's no right or wrong. Oftentimes, right, I often say this, right? There's no good response here, right? It's just the best of bad options or the least worst. And that, you know, that degree of discomfort is something that, you know, our, you know, these crisis situations are, you know, naturally evoke. And so as, you know, over the last 4 years, right, like we've recognized some hallmarks and companies have done it really well. And then the process to make sure that, you know, that they can get together and effectively respond cross-functionally as business, strategic, and operational leaders need to some major cyber crisis.
I would imagine you have to see that happening from the top down, the problem-solving culture, because it sometimes doesn't happen organically. In fact, you get pushback from the top.
Yeah, you heard me use that word diplomatic up front, right? I think that's both for our facilitators. That's, you know, both within the company, right? I think like that's something that we just see companies whose cultures, you know, are really open and problem solving focused, right? They tend to do very well, even if they don't have very strict roles, responsibilities, and procedures. If they have a very healthy problem-solving team, and then they, you know, their team that is kind of without ego as well, right? Of knowing like, hey, this is where my expertise might end. This is where I pick up the phone and call an expert that's really good at this as their core competency, their core job. And so like, that's why you hear me say, you know, problem solving, diplomacy, you know, checking your ego at the door. These are all really effective hallmarks to training, to being very effective when it comes to, you know, the real life.
So you mentioned facilitators. I've gotten to experience them, but could you tell the audience what sort of some of the subject matter expert areas are for your facilitators? Because when you're there, you get to see it firsthand, especially like in the newsroom aspect. And then I'm sure there are others. So tell me a little bit about these subject matter experts.
Yeah, I often say like they're unicorns, candidly, right? Like you're looking for somebody who has really, you know, really rich technical experience that can be able to speak down to that level, right? When they get challenged, they understand really, you know, the foundation of these experiences. But then you want these people that also are really balanced at, you know, from a business acumen, and they understand everything that gets incorporated into a business, right? And it's difficult for one person to have all this knowledge, and we're all getting better in training every day, right? But if you think about some of the knowledge sets you want some of these facilitators to have, right? How it does the cybersecurity or IT major incident management process, you know, what's the best practice and how does that work? So you want knowledge in incident response in IT incident management. You also want to have knowledge in, you know, a degree of business continuity, right? Because it's a crisis because it's disrupting a business, right? We often like to start with customers. Why does your business exist? Most likely it exists to make money in one form or another, right? Unless you're a nonprofit, right? Or a government, you know, et cetera, then you're probably providing some degree of service and you exist to provide service, right? But for most of our, you know, like for-profit private organizations, right? Like we start talking about, you know, why does your business exist? It exists to make money in one way or another. And IT helps that, right? And so how does this business that's in a crisis, because the business is being disrupted, how do we get that business to continue? So business continuity is a part of that. And a lot of times, you know, when it comes to business continuity, especially for IT continuity, a lot of customers tend to think, oh, disaster recovery, right? Oh, we're going to recover our way out of this. I got the get out of jail free card over here that, you know, that passes me straight to recovery and we can just go to our backup environment, right? And that gets back to the expectations reality setting. Like, just because we do have a disaster recovery plan, that doesn't mean it's going to give us 100% replicability, you know, in 1 hour. It's not like turning on a backup generator, right? The full equals the same amount of power supply. So, you know, so we go incident response process, incident management process, business continuity processes, disaster recovery processes, and then ultimately, crisis management processes. So strategically, how does a business handle a crisis? Those are really some of the core knowledge sets that we really try and look to. And then communications comes into this, diplomatic interpersonal skills, charisma, gravitas, being able to communicate effectively, hold a room, all of those kind of intangible skills come into play as
interesting,
well.
Interesting. It's just great to experience. You could just feel it when you get in the room. So, you know, we've been in this business long enough. We have to throw around terms like structured and unstructured data. So I'm sort of curious of what kind of structured and unstructured data do you capture as a result of these sessions? What's the exhaust that comes off of it? And in capturing that, what are the first one is like, what are the top mistakes in the data that you capture? What are the top mistakes that you find with the tech people, the tech guys and the CISOs attendees versus the other ones? We'll get into the other ones afterward, but like, obviously you're doing this for a reason because they're not doing everything right. Otherwise they wouldn't have to go there. What is it you find out coming in that they're doing? I wouldn't say wrong. Let's make it more diplomatic, as you say.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even say doing it wrong, right? Like when we go to these events, oftentimes they are champions, right? They're the ones that are kind of sponsoring us and championing us to the rest of the business, right? And what we really want to understand, right, is what the company's cybersecurity posture looks like, right? Like what the resiliencies they have in place, if they have initiatives that the security team's trying to get done, right? And if the security team really understands how the rest of the business, how would they map to the rest of the business and enable the rest of the business to succeed, right? There's known gaps or known risks, right? So we really try and go through workshops with that security team to understand, you know, what are some of the risks to the business that you see today? And then, you know, what are some of the things that you're doing to address that or some of the gaps that you might have, right? That I kind of put my military hat back on and I think, you know,
most likely course of action, most dangerous course of action. And you want to be able to have kind of a risk mitigation strategy against that. So I put that strategic approach layer, you know, I put that cybersecurity team, our technical teams that come to us through that kind of prism, right? To get them to understand what is the most likely and most dangerous course of action to your business through the security lens, right? So we try and work with them through that. And a lot of times it's just trying to understand that, right? A lot of, you know, part of our cybersecurity practice, right? We're not naturally business. We don't come from the line of business, right? We're generally focused on protecting things that are, you know, within our control and within the business, but, you know, we're not really out working on CRMs and we're not working on the supply chain and we're not working out in manufacturing warehouses. So really seeing how the rest of the business operates is, you know, tends to be something that's maybe perhaps not a degree of a blind spot, but just things that we don't get actively involved in, you know, just due to our, you know, kind of the nature of what we do already.
Yeah, I came in, my blind spot was coming in as I think I know cybersecurity, but I'm not a professional. So coming in as a communication specialist, I think I was on your PR. I think there's a PR panel there that you have that I got anointed to going on because of my background. So I just curious what you find in your reviews of the non-technical people, the people that really only know cybersecurity based on what they read in the news for the most part. What kind of things do you think you have to impart on them that they might not have coming in? Because it's a different world that, you know, everybody hears about, well, we block the breach, we stop the data flow, but you know, now what do? We have this stuff called the press out there and we have the news cycles, we have social media.
Yeah, it's, you know, for the non-technical team, some of the lessons that we often get out there, right, is, you know, I'll just start with the first one, communications, right? Just communications as an in general lesson learned, right? So one, there's language barriers, right? So what is an IP address? What is a CVE? You know, who are these threat actors? So a lot of the cybersecurity teams will attempt to or translate a cybersecurity ticket that's based in a lot of cybersecurity jargon and lingo and terms that are familiar to them into what is kind of this crisis ticket. How do we translate that cybersecurity ticket to what the crisis management cross-functional team can actually understand and why this is a crisis to them, right? So there's a lot of that kind of language barrier that already occurs. And so what we see is that education gap, right? You heard me talk about assumptions and expectations gap. The assumption and expectation going into these by the non-cybersecurity teams is that this is a CISO problem. This is a CIO problem. It's my job just to make a business run, or it's my job just to, you know, do communications or HR or finance, right? Come to me when you need money. And that's actually not, you know, just that role. Sure, that is part of the role, but they actually have a very collaborative problem-solving part and a very unique perspective to how the business is being disrupted and what unique considerations need to be had to their unique role in the company, right? They're a part of this crisis management team for a reason. And this crisis management team is to steer the company, you know, into some new direction, you know, in response to an opportunity or response to a threat in this situation, right? And so that crisis management team is responsible for making sure that they can respond to the threat and pivot their business, not just the cybersecurity team, but pivot the whole business to being able to, you know, effectively respond, recover, and hopefully even take advantage of this threat going forward to the new reality.
That's great. I'd like to take a moment first to welcome our audience to this week's episode of Health Stealth Radio, bringing you insights from the shadows of healthcare enterprise and patient cybersecurity. We're syndicated on Healthcare Now Radio and are part of the Chime Digital Health Insights family. Let's continue with Jake Paulson on the IBM X4 Cyber Range and Crisis Management Team. Talked about it in your introduction. I mean, the stress that's involved with CISOs and people that are security related is at an all-time high. I would imagine that part of the thinking and what you're doing, it might be more subliminal than obvious that this is going to this coursework is, or simulation is, a stress reduction exercise, would you say?
That's the intent, right? Because, like, you know, you're attempting to illuminate that unknown, right? You know, in the military, there's a fog of war and a friction of war, right? Like, you're attempting to reduce that fog of war. You're attempting to get people to really understand that when this crisis level cybersecurity incident occurs, it's not just the CISO and the CIO that are in the crosshairs, right? It's the business that's in the crosshairs. And as a team, they need to respond and recover, right? And that just being able to get the rest of the executive and, you know, and senior management to understand and really see their role as a part of that team and not as, you know, waiting for the CIO and the CISO to do everything and to get it, you know, and to get this fixed, you know, to understand where they fit and they contribute to that. That helps reduce a lot of that stress of the unknown to the CIO and CISOs, right? And like I said in the beginning, right, or earlier, the more we can champion with those CIOs and CISOs and really understand their risk profile and, you know, what they're really worried about, the more we can make sure we create a scenario and we create, you know, an effective outcome that helps alleviate a lot of their concerns and helps the business understand what their concerns are, what the IT team's concerns are going into a situation like this and what, you know, they see at some of the blind spots so that they can deliberately have an effective outcome that establishes more resiliency and gives them a really big path forward.
Because of the increase in the platforms and the importance of social media platforms, has that also evolved in terms of the simulation of how social media plays into response and for the positive and for the negative?
It really has, right? And I mean, one of the key lessons that we come out of this, you know, kind of circling back to earlier for the non-technical teams is, you know, really big need for holding statements, really well-established holding statements and ways to, you know, kind of in this court of public opinion that you're in a real battle for, you know, for the future of your company. And that court of public opinion has a variety of different stakeholders that you need to uniquely engage, right? You need to uniquely engage, you know, the media, you need to uniquely engage your customers, your employees, your business partners, your supply chain, your shareholders, your board of directors, every single one of those different audiences, those stakeholders, they need their own engagement management strategy, right? Like not just a one-time communication, not just a one-time holding statement that gets sent to them, but follow-ups, where they can go for next information, what's being done about it, you know, things that make them feel confident and comfortable that the company that's, you know, the steward of their data and the steward of their finances and of their investment really has their hands around this. They're prepared and they're putting, you know, all the effort forth and they're taking it seriously to respond to it.
So just for definitional purposes, when you say holding statement, we're talking about unified messaging for the most part, something like that, right?
Yeah, right. So something that just establishes like, hey, we're aware that.
Right. We're all going to say the same thing. Yep.
Yeah. Something we're all going to say the same thing, right? And like, you know, often, right? Like imagine a, you know, reporter, kind of like a dog with a bone, like he picks up and calls one person, you know, he or she, if they're looking for a specific answer or a statement, you know, they don't get no, you know, do you say no comment to the media? Do you actually pass them to your corporate communications team? Does anybody have the ability to make any statement they want to the media, right? Like little lessons like that are really important to make sure how does your organization respond from a centralized communication strategy to all these different audiences?
Just for the purposes of our audience visualizing us on radio, I'm sure there is still something equivalent to a CNN studio in the range. And there was a lot of ticker boards for Wall Street showing the effect of not having unified messaging on immediate effect on stock market. So I thought that was one of the most fascinating things of connecting the dots visually. And my experience was that it was actually really happening. Like, oh my God, I was the PR guy that says something outlandish. And next thing I know, I see the stock dropping. So I have to ask this because I'm a cross-cultural communications professor and in the graduate courses I talk about, I'm always talking about how, you know, the one size fits all approach in situations like this just doesn't work. Did you find anything different in terms of your international audiences or subsidiaries of the companies that are part of your client base that you've had to do this differently, like with the Japanese company versus an American company in terms of the way they communicate?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you heard me use the word diplomatic more than once, twice, three times so far in this call, right? You need to be really diplomatic both as a facilitator, right? And as you create these experiences and understanding, you know, cultural competencies, you know, and awareness across the variety of different companies and cultures that you're going to experience, right? So, you know, that we see some cultures that, you know, in some companies, their leadership teams really won't, you know, that kind of open problem solving won't occur as naturally, you know, for a variety of different reasons, right? We've also seen other cultures where, you know, the CEO will be like, I need to be the person to make this statement now to the public. It needs to be me on sitting at that desk in front of everybody, right? And sometimes that is the right decision. And sometimes there's both pros and cons, benefits and consequences to decisions like that, right? And so we attempt to really always analyze the culture and really showcase some of the best practices that we've seen as hallmarks of really effective crisis responses. And we do that through case studies, right? We do that through best practices we've seen through customers coming through us, the 1,000 customers that have come through our experiences, about 17,000 total attendees for the last 8 years, right? We really try and make sure that we're communicating to our audience like, hey, have you thought about this? Or here's the best practice we've seen. You should consider this. And so we really try and make sure that our experience, you know, the people who are coming through our experiences are walking away with understanding, you know, going forward, here are some of the things they should consider, and really kind of priming them with those aha moments to really be thinking more about how they can bring these lessons back to their organizations.
That's great. We've got about a minute left, and I might have to beg our producer to just give me a little bit of elbow room here. Considering the world of technology, I'm assuming that you do this mostly on the facilities that you have, the on-ground facilities, or maybe it's mobile now. Is there a extended reality or virtual reality aspect to any of this that you see coming into these kinds of simulations?
Yeah, I often say, like, you know, I can do this in a laptop in a parking garage, right? Or like with handouts in a park. I think that's a military person to me that's so used to doing things with so little technology, right? But, you know, the reality is, right, when you're having some completely enterprise crippling ransomware event, like, your IT is already going to be struggling to an extent, right? It's already going to be on, you know, on emergency life support. So you need to be thinking about how to be having these experiences and, you know, and really conducting a business response, how your business will respond if enterprise IT doesn't exist, right? Do you have out of band communication channels? How many people actually have the old fashioned phone call recall rosters, you know, either printed out on their, you know, printed out either in their home or in their briefcase, if they carry a briefcase, or on their phone, right? A lot of people take for granted that they're going to be able to just look things up, you know, wherever they keep their company's roster, their phone numbers, right?
I just got the signal, Jake. So I think we hit the end. One of the things I did want to ask you, and I don't know if they could squeeze this in, was about how your military background affected the work you do. But you did an excellent job throughout the presentation of talking about how you wove the military in. And there's a lot of debate sometimes of whether military people make the best because they know defense, or whether they make the best. And I think you've said it better than anyone that I've asked the question to, because they know the chain of command and the process parts that aren't necessarily military things or structure that are baked into the military. So I'd like to thank you for the time that you gave us today. Very insightful, very exciting. And I hope I have a chance to visit again and see what the next rev of the Cyber Center is.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. I appreciate everybody's time today. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us today in the shadows for this episode of Health Stealth Radio with Frank Katita. If you like the program, please be sure to share your comments on our social media sites, or feel free to contact us with suggestions for new and stealthy show themes. We look forward to welcoming you again for our next broadcast. In the meantime, stay safe out there.